Then he remembered how he thought at 17 and what the prime motivator in life was. Jen was looking over at John with just a touch of a sly grin.
"Ben, how's your grandpa?"
"Fine, ma'am. We was out fishing together on Saturday on Flat Creek, and you should have seen the brookie he reeled in, 16 inches. Made his day." Jen laughed.
"I remember going fishing with him on that same creek. He'd always bait my hook."
And she shuddered.
"Lord, how I hated doing that. Tell him I said hi."
"Yes, ma'am, I will." "You need a ride home?" John asked, finally relenting. "No, sir, it isn't far." And he nodded to the other side of the interstate. "I can cross right over from here." "All right then, Ben. Your folks are most likely worried. Get home now."
"Yes, sir. Sorry, sir."
"Hey, shorty, happy birthday."
"Thanks, Ben."
Like most kid sisters, she had a bit of a crush on her big sister's boyfriend. And Ben, being a smart kid, but also, John grudgingly realized, a good kid, had a liking for Jennifer. "Night, Elizabeth." There was an awkward moment, the two of them gazing at each other. She blushed slightly. Ben turned away, walked over to the fence bordering the interstate, and in seconds had scrambled up and over it. John watched him cross. Several people standing around their cars went up to Ben, and John didn't move, just watching. Ben pointed towards the direction of the exit into Black Mountain and then moved on. John breathed a sigh of relief.
"Excuse me, excuse me?"
John looked over again to the fence that Ben had just scaled. A woman, well-dressed, dark gray business suit with shiny, shoulder-length blonde hair, was coming up the grassy slope, walking a bit awkwardly in her high heels.
"Ma'am?"
"Can you tell me what's going on?"
As she approached John, half a dozen more got out of their stalled cars and started towards the fence as well.
"I'm sorry, ma'am. I think I know just about as much as you do."
"I was just driving along,"
and she pointed back to the stalled BMW 330 on the westbound side,
"and the engine just went off. The same with everyone else out here."
"I don't know for sure,"
John said, now choosing his words carefully as he watched more people approaching. Four of them men, in their late 20s, maybe early 30s, big guys, looked like construction workers. Some sort of instinct began to kick in as he watched them come up behind the woman.
"Hey, buddy, how come your car's running?"
one of them asked. The man speaking was nearly as tall as John, stocky and well-built.
"Don't know why it's running. It just is."
"Well, it seems strange, don't you think? All these cars out here dead and that old junk is still running?"
"Yeah, guess it does seem strange."
"What'd you do to make it run?"
"It just turned on, that's all,"
John said quietly, fixing the man with his gaze and not letting it drop.
"Sir, can you give me a lift into town?" the woman asked.
He looked at the fence that Ben had scaled with such ease. John caught a glimpse of Ben going over the chain-link fence on the far side of the highway and then trotting up the road towards his house. More and yet more people were approaching. An elderly couple, a woman leading a child of about 6, a couple of teenagers, an overweight man in an expensive business suit, collar open and tie pulled down. A trucker, over in the eastbound lane, was out of his rig, slowly walking towards John.
"Ma'am, I don't see how you'll get over that fence," John said, nodding to the chain-link fence that separated them.
"It's just over a mile to exit 64.
And he pointed west. "Don't get off at exit 65. There's just a convenience store there." He pointed to the lane for exit 65 just a couple of hundred yards away that arced off the interstate just before the road curved up over a bridge spanning the railroad tracks.
"Go to exit 64. You can walk it in 20 minutes. There's 2 motels there, one of them a Holiday Inn with a good restaurant as well. You should be able to still get a room till this thing clears up."
"John?"
It was Jen, standing behind him, whispering.
"Help her."
He let his hand drift behind his back and put his hand out forcefully, extended, a signal for Jen to shut up. In many ways, 8 years here had indeed changed him. Women were addressed as ma'am, and doors were held open for them, no matter what their age. If a man spoke inappropriately to a woman in public and another man was nearby, there would be a fight brewing. The woman in the business suit looked at him appealingly. To refuse her went against a lifetime of thinking and conditioning. Hell, there was even a touch of something going on here that he never would have dreamed of but 10 minutes ago. Since Mary had died, there had been a few brief flirtations, even one brief affair with a professor at the State University, but down deep his heart was never in it. Mary was still too close. The woman on the other side of the fence was attractive, professional-looking, early to mid-30s. A quick glance to her left hand showed no ring. An earlier incarnation of himself, before Mary, he'd have cut the fence down to get to this woman and act as the rescuer. John was almost tempted now to do so. But there was that something else now, a gut instinct that ran deeper. Something had gone wrong. What, he still wasn't sure, but there were too many anomalies, with the power off, the car stalled except for the Edsel, no planes. Something was wrong. And at this moment, for the first time in a long while, his city's survival senses were kicking in. Growing up in a working-class suburb of Newark in the 60s and 70s, he had learned survival. He was only 7 when the big riots hit Newark in 67, dividing off for a generation any thought of what some called diversity. Italians stuck to their neighborhoods, Poles and the Irish to theirs, Hispanics to theirs, blacks to theirs. And God save you if you got caught in the wrong neighborhood after dark, and usually in daylight as well. The interstate at this instant had become the wrong neighborhood. The way the 4 construction workers stood and gazed at him and the car, the one car with a motor still running, was triggering a warning. One of them was obviously drunk, the type that struck John as a belligerent drunk. Something was changing, had changed, in just the last few hours. If alone, John might have chanced it, and chances were nothing at all would go wrong. But he was a father. His 2 girls and his mother-in-law would be in that car. "Come on, buddy," the one worker said, his voice now edged with a taunting edge. "Help the lady. We'll push over for you. Then we'll climb over, and you can give us a lift as well." She looked back at the 4. "I don't need your help," she said coldly. The drunk laughed softly. John felt trapped, especially as he spared a quick glance back to Jennifer. Suppose the car was taken right now. It would be a long haul back for her. At that moment he caught a glance from the truck driver. There was a slight nod, and ever so casually he let his right hand, which had been concealed behind his back, drift into view. He was holding a light-caliber pistol. There was a moment of gut-tightening for John, but the exchange of glances said it all. "It's okay, buddy. I'm watching things here." John looked back to the woman. "Ma'am, I'm sorry. I've got to get my kids home. You just walk a little less than a mile to the west and you'll find food and shelter." "Rotten shit," the drunk growled and moved to start climbing the fence. "Girls, into the car," John snapped, and there was no hesitation. The doors slammed behind them. John backed up to the car. The drunk had a hard time negotiating his footing. John slipped into the driver's seat, slammed into reverse, and floored it. "Son of a bitch! All we want is a lift!" And as the drunk half-dangled from the fence, he flipped John off. Flooring the gas, John continued to back up all the way to the turnoff to their road, threw the gear into forward, and roared up the dirt road.
"John Matheson, I can't believe you left that lady like that, especially with those men around her."
"I have a family," John said coldly, looking into the rearview mirror to where Elizabeth and Jennifer were in the back seat, both of them silent. He could sense their accusation that Dad had chickened out. He shook his head and said nothing. He pulled into the driveway. The dog started to bound around him, but then, sensing his mood, shifted their attention to Jennifer and Elizabeth.
"Girls, it's getting dark. Remember the hurricane last year when we all piled into my bedroom? It'll be like that tonight. Elizabeth, get out the Coleman lantern. You know how to light it. Jennifer, you help her."
"Come on, Dad. I think you're being a little uptight."
"Just do it, Elizabeth," he said slowly and forcefully.
"All right."
The two headed to the door. Jennifer pestered Elizabeth as to what her birthday present was.
"And Elizabeth, after you get the lantern lit, help Jennifer with her injection. Don't keep the medication out of the fridge any longer than you have to."
"Okay, Dad."
"Then feed the dogs."
"Sure, Dad."
The girls went in. John fished in his pocket for a cigarette, pulled it out, and lit it.
"Are you going back to help that woman?"
"No."
Jen was silent for a moment.
"I'm surprised at you, John."
"I know I'm right. I go down to that highway and those bastards might take this car."
"But what about her, the woman? Does it bother you?"
He looked at Jen sharply. "What the hell do you mean?"
"That woman. And there was another one with a small child. They could be raped."
He shook his head.
"No, not yet. Those guys weren't all that bad. The drunk was out of hand, the loudmouth one was just trying to show off in front of his buddies and the woman. Sure, it's strange, our car running, the others not, and if I went back down, they'd be tempted to take it. Or worse yet, I'd be stuck all night running a shuttle service for everyone stalled on the highway, and running into yet more drunks with a bad attitude. But rape? No. Too many others down there are okay. Everyone else is sober. The truck driver down there had a gun in his hand, though you might not have seen it. He'll keep order. That woman and the others will be okay. I wouldn't worry about that yet."
"Yet?"
He sighed, shook his head, let his finished cigarette fall, then fished out another one and began to smoke it.
"I'd like you to stay here tonight, Jen. The girls would love it."
"You worried about me?"
"Frankly, yes. I don't like the idea of you driving around alone at night in this monster."
And as he spoke, he slapped the hood of the Edsel.
"I'll stay."
He looked down at her, surprised there was no argument about the cat needing to be put out or some other excuse. It was dark enough now he couldn't see her face, but he could sense her voice. She was afraid.
"It's so dark,"
she whispered. He looked around. It was dark. There wasn't a single light down in the town, except for what appeared to be the flicker of a Coleman lamp, some candles. All the houses rimming the valley were dark as well. No reflected lights from the highway, none of the annoying high-intensity lithium glare from the service stations at the exit, not a light showing from the skyline of Asheville. There was a dull red glow, what looked to be the fire up on the side of the mountain towards Craggy Dome. The stars arced the heavens with a magnificent splendor. He hadn't seen stars like this since being out in the desert in Saudi Arabia, before the oil wells started to burn. There was absolutely no ambient light to drown the stars out. It was magnificent, and he found calming as well.
"Head on in, Jen. I'll be along in a minute."
She left his side, moving slowly. From inside the house he could now see the glare of the Coleman, and a moment later heard laughter, which was reassuring. He finished the second cigarette and let it drop, watching as it glowed on the concrete pavement of the driveway. It slowly winked out. Opening the door of his Talon, he slipped in and turned the switch. Nothing. Not even a stutter from the starter motor. No dashboard lights. Nothing. He reached under the seat, pulled out a heavy 6D cell flashlight, and flicked the switch. It came on. When he went into the house, the girls were already making a game out of camping out.
"Dad, Jennifer's new tester doesn't work,"
Elizabeth said.
"What?"
"The new blood tester. I found the old one, though, and we used that. She's okay."
"Fine, honey."
Somehow, that little fact now did set off more alarm bells within. The new testing kit was a high-tech marvel with a built-in computer that kept a downloadable record of her blood levels. In another week, she was supposed to be fitted out with one of the new implanted insulin pumps, and something told him he should be glad they had not yet done so.
Okay.
Elizabeth started to turn away. He took a deep breath. Elizabeth?
Yeah, Dad?
You and Ben. He felt embarrassed suddenly. You know, is there anything we should talk about?
Come on, Dad, now?
Yeah, you're right. Get your sister settled in and let's call it a night.
Dad, it's not even 8 yet.
Like the hurricane, kid. We went 4 days then, and by the end of it we were asleep when it got dark and up at dawn.
Okay.
He looked into his bedroom, and Jennifer was, to his delight, lining up her new beanies along what she had already claimed was her side of the king-size waterbed. Clutched under her arm was her beloved Rabs, the stuffed rabbit that Bob and Barbara gave to her the day she was born, and which had been Jennifer's steadfast companion for 12 years. Once a fuzzy white, old Rabs was now a sort of permanent dingy gray. Rabs had survived much, upset stomachs, once being left behind at a restaurant, and the family drove nearly 100 miles back to retrieve him, while Jennifer cried every mile of the way. A kidnapping by a neighbor's dog, with Dad then spending 2 days prowling the woods looking for him. He was patched, worn smooth in places, and though she was 12 today, Rabs was still her buddy, and John suspected always would be. Until finally there might be a day when, left behind as a young lady went off to college, Rabs would then rest on her father's desk to remind him of the precious times before. The dogs had finished up chomping down their dinner, and he let them out for their evening run. Ginger was a bit nervous going out, since usually he'd throw on the spotlights for them. At this time of year, bears, with their newborn cubs, were wandering about, raccoons were out, and the sight of either would nearly trigger a heart attack. She did her business quickly and darted back in, settling down at Jennifer's feet.
No school tomorrow?
Jennifer asked hopefully.
Well, if the lights come on during the night, you'll know there's school. If not, no school.
Hope it stays pitch black all night.
You want me in the guest room? Jen asked, carrying the Coleman lantern.
In with us, Grandma,
Jennifer announced.
That puts me in the middle, Elizabeth complained, and Brat here kicks when she's asleep.
All right, ladies, I'll be out in my office. Now get to sleep.
Jen smiled and went into the bathroom, carrying the lantern.
Night, girls.
Love you, Daddy.
Love you, too.
He closed the door and went into his office. He sat down for a moment at his desk, setting the flashlight on end so that the beam pointed to the ceiling, filling the room with a reflected glow. The office had always driven Mary crazy. She expected better of a military man, to which his retort always was that she had also married a professor. Stacks of paper were piled up on either side of his desk, filed, he used to say, by geological strata. A floor-to-ceiling bookshelf to his left held books 2 rows deep, the references for whatever he was working on at the moment, or what interested him, on the nearest shelf. The other walls were lined with photos, his framed degrees, Mary's degree, pictures of the kids. He stood gazing at the bookshelf for a moment, pulled several books from the outer layer aside, found what he wanted, and fished the volume out. He had not opened it in years, not since leaving the war college. Sitting down and propping the book on his knees, he held the flashlight with one hand, checked the chapter headings of the work, a mid-1990s dot matrix computer printout, then sat back and read for half an hour. He finally put the report down on his desk. Behind him was a locked cabinet, and opening his desk, he pulled out a single key, unlocked the cabinet, and swung the door open. He reached in, hesitated for a second, deciding which one.
then pulled out his pump 20-gauge bird gun. From the ammunition rack, he opened up a box of birdshot and slipped 3 rounds in. The birdshot was not a killing load, except at very close range, but definitely a deterrent. Next was the pistol. It was, he knew, an eccentric touch, a cap-and-ball Colt Dragoon, a big, heavy mother of a gun, the sight of it enough to scare the crap out of most drunks. John had actually been forced to use it once for real, back in his undergraduate days, before he met Mary. He was living off campus, in a farmhouse shared with half a dozen other guys, all of them rather hippie-ish that year, long-haired, the year he definitely smoked a little too much dope, something that Mary had made clear would stop on day one if they were to date. Some local good old boys had taken a distinct dislike to long-haired faggots living nearby, and one night did a drive-by, blowing out the kitchen door with a load of buckshot, yelling for the faggots to come out and get what they deserved. His roommates were freaked. One of them cried that they were in the middle of deliverance. But their attackers had not counted on one of the faggots being from New Jersey, already into Civil War reenacting, and someone who knew guns. He had come out, dragoon revolver in hand, leveled it, and fired off 2 rounds of his cannon, not aiming to kill, just to make them duck a bit. After pumping out the 2 rounds, he lowered his aim straight to the chest of the redneck with the shotgun. "Next shot's for real," John said calmly. The rednecks piled into their truck and disappeared in one hell of a hurry. His buddy, standing on the porch, in awe as he walked back, feeling more than a little like Gary Cooper in High Noon. "Peace through superior firepower," he said calmly, then went inside and poured himself one hell of a vodka to calm down while his roommates chattered away, reenacting the drama for half the night. What had truly scared him? The realization that he was ready to kill one of the bastards if they had tried to venture another shot. Reflecting on it later, he didn't like that feeling at all, and hoped he'd never have it again. Though he would, years later in Iraq, but at least then he was not pulling the trigger, just ordering others to do so. The following morning, a Saturday, the landlord had come over with a case of beer, asked to see this now legendary gun, and said that, "You boys got some respect now." A month later, stopping in a roadside bar with a couple of friends to get a beer, John had run into one of the four who had been his harassers. John recognized him. There was a tense moment, and the redneck broke out laughing, brought John a beer, and told everyone the story, concluding with, "This Yankee boy's okay," and they shook hands. Damn. Even then, he did love the South. The revolver was already loaded, and he put it on his desk. He suddenly realized someone was in the room and looked up. It was Jen in the doorway. "This is serious, isn't it?" she asked. "Go to sleep," he hesitated. "Mom?" She stood silent for a moment, nodded, then disappeared. Without taking his shoes off, John stretched out on the sofa in his office, laying the shotgun down on the floor by his side. It was a long couple of hours before he finally drifted to sleep. As he began to fall asleep, Zack disengaged himself from Jennifer's embrace, came out to the office, and with a sigh, settled down by John's side. Chapter 3 Day 2 The scream woke him up. He fumbled for the shotgun, got half to his feet, and heard Elizabeth cursing.
"There's no hot water, dammit!"
Putting the gun down, he walked into the bedroom as Elizabeth stormed out of the bathroom, a towel wrapped around her.
"Dad, there's no hot water!"
"What in hell did you expect?" he grumbled, heart still racing a bit.
Jennifer was sitting up, rabs tucked under her arm, smiling.
"No school, Dad?"
"Nope."
"Great.
Dad, how am I going to take a shower?"
"Take it cold. It won't kill you," he muttered, and then wandered into the kitchen. Coffee, damn it, coffee.
He pulled the foil bag down, the paper filter, made the coffee extra strong, filled the pot up, poured it in, and flicked the switch. He stood there like an idiot for a good minute before the realization hit. Ah, shit. He pulled a small pot out from under the cabinet, filled it with water, and walked out onto the porch, flicked on the grill, and set the pot on it. Fumbling in his pocket, he got out a cigarette and lit it. Though he was watching the pot, it finally did come to a boil, and a minute later he had a cup. Doing it the old way he had learned in the Boy Scouts, throw a couple of spoonfuls of coffee into the cup, pour the hot water in, and to hell with the grinds.
Got one for me?
It was Jen.
Sure.
He mixed a second cup, and she looked at it with disdain. She went back into the kitchen and opened the fridge, sniffing the plastic jug of milk after opening it, then came back out on the porch, taking a sip.
"Keep your teeth closed, and that will filter out the grinds," John said, finally forcing his first smile of the day.
"Got to find an old-style percolator," she said. "Always thought that made the best coffee anyhow. Never liked those Mr. Coffee machines."
It was a bit chilly out, and he found it invigorating. The coffee and cigarette were working their magic, bringing him awake. Unlike the vast majority of men who had made careers in the army, he had never adjusted to early morning rising, and hated all those who could do it, especially the cheerful ones. His instinct always was to be a night owl, to go to sleep around 2 or 3, then wake up at 9 or 10 for his first lecture at 11. The college had learned that quickly, and never scheduled a class for him prior to that time. But he did have to admit, mornings were beautiful, and he regretted missing them at times. Mary had been a morning person. He thought about her, remembering how sometimes at dawn she'd wake him up, at least for a few minutes, to... The memory was too painful, and he let it drop.
"That fire is still burning," Jen said,
pointing to Craggy Dome. He nodded. The flame had spread out, a plume of smoke flattening out, then drifting down towards the Asheville Reservoir in the valley below. Looked like 100 acres or more. Far in the distance, out on the distant horizon, he saw 2 more plumes of smoke from fires. The world was silent, no traffic. Down in Black Mountain, nothing was moving. Nothing had changed.
"Can I have some?"
It was Elizabeth, hair wet, rubbing it with a towel, a heavy winter bathrobe wrapped around her, shivering.
"Sure, sweetheart."
And he mixed up 1/3 cup, which she drank without complaint. Jennifer came out on the porch as well, rabs tucked under her arm. She looked so adorable. When asleep, or half awake, as she was now, there was still that certain look. The eyes of a baby still there.
"You sure there's no school?"
"Doubt it."
She yawned, turned about without comment, and went back inside.
"You do your blood test?" he asked.
"Yeah, Dad, it's okay."
And she wandered back to the bedroom to go back to sleep. "I think I'll head down to town now, see what's going on."
"Can I come?"
Elizabeth asked.
"No, I'd like you to stay here."
"Aw, come on, Dad. Everyone will be down there. I want to see what's happening."
He took her gently by the arm and led her away from the screen door.
"I want you here to guard the house."
She gave him a sarcastic smirk.
"From what? Terrorists?"
"Don't joke about it," he said forcefully, and she fell silent, looking up at him.
"You know how to handle the shotgun. It's the 20-gauge, so don't be afraid of it. The safety is off, but I don't have a round chambered in it. So if need be, pump and then shoot."
"Dad, you're freaking me out here."
"Listen, Liz, I'm not joking around. I think something serious has gone down."
"What?"
"Look around. There's no power, nothing."
"It'll come back on."
He didn't say anything, just staring at her.
"Anyone you know coming up the driveway, okay. But if it's a stranger, I want you to stand in the doorway, but use the frame to cover yourself. Let them see you have a gun pointed in their direction. Don't take any bullshit or con lines. I don't care how pathetic they might look. If they're looking for a phone, water, help, just tell them to walk on into town and there'll be people there to help them. Got it?
Yeah, sure.
Got it? And this time his voice was sharp.
Yes, Dad.
If they try anything, anything at all, you don't hesitate, Liz. None of this warning shot crap. You aim straight at their midsection and squeeze. If it's more than one man, drop the one closest to you, or anyone armed.
Dad, you're scaring me.
He put his hands on her shoulders and squeezed them tight. I taught you and your mom to shoot, and remember what I said about what was most dangerous.
A woman with a gun who doesn't have the guts to use it, she recited.
Mary had always said it was such a sexist line. A guy like that drunk last night, he can sense it if you are not really going to shoot. You make it clear you're not taking... John hesitated. Not taking any shit, and chances are you'll go through life and never have to pull a trigger.
Okay, Dad.
He forced a smile. I'm just being paranoid, sweetie. Keep Jennifer close by. If Pat comes up to play, so much the better.
What about Ben?
He hesitated. Jen was inside. No problem.
He really is a sweet guy, Dad, if you'd give him a chance.
He nodded. I know that.
Why do you dislike him so much, Dad?
You know. She smiled.
Like he's going to get beyond a little making out with me? I think you used to call it past first base.
He stiffened a bit. It was the first time she was even being slightly direct. All the female-related issues he had left to the care of Grandma Jen, including the talks, other than the traditional old-style father routine of glaring at any boy who started to hang around. John knew he wasn't much of a father for this new century, maybe a bit old-fashioned, but that was the way he was raised, and he had assumed for so many years that such things were Mary's territory.
It's because of Mom, in a way, isn't it?
How's that?
You know, we lost Mom, but you lost your wife, your friend and companion. Jennifer and I, we're filling in for some of the loss, and down deep you hate the thought that we're growing up, and in doing that, eventually we're moving away from you as well.
He didn't say anything, a bit startled by her insight. What makes you think that?
Oh, the therapist we went to after Mom died. But it's the truth, Dad. It's okay. I love you, Daddy. I always will, she said, going up on tiptoes to kiss him on the cheek. You'll always be my number one guy.
He hugged her, eyes filled with tears. Thanks, honey. They stepped back from each other, both feeling a bit awkward.
I'll see what I can work up for breakfast, she said, and went back into the kitchen.
Your girl is definitely growing up. It was Jen coming up to him, offering a second cup of coffee. He sniffled a bit, nodded, then smiled.
Mary was like that at 16, wise beyond her years. Used to throw Tyler for a loop sometimes.
John drank the second cup. It was cooling, but that didn't matter. Though two cups and two cigarettes without a breakfast did make his stomach feel a bit jumpy. You mind if I borrow the monster, go downtown, and see what is going on?
No,
and she smiled. The Mustang, though, that's still a different story. As he drove past the interstate, all the cars were exactly where they had been the night before. The road was empty, except for a lone trucker, sitting in his cab, door open, puffing on a cigar, the driver waving to John. It was the guy from the night before, and the sight of him was a reassurance. John felt a bit of relief, fearful that something ugly might have indeed happened down here during the night, but all was quiet, no sign of any problems. Coming up State Street, he passed the elementary school. The front door was propped open, and for a second he wondered if indeed school was open today, but then realized that all the school buses were still parked in the lot. There was a hand-lettered sign out front, Emergency Shelter.
Pete's Barbecue House, the restaurant across the street, had volunteered their big outdoor grill, the kind used at festivals and fairs. And there was Pete, set up in front of the school, wearing his absurd pink apron and pink chef's hat with a smiling pig painted on it, a couple of kettles on the grill, a line formed for coffee and barbecue for breakfast. Typical of Pete, always there for the town. John honked, and Pete looked up in surprise, as did those on the line, and Pete waved. The light up ahead was off, and John had to slow down, half a dozen cars blocking the road. It forced him to swing over to the eastbound side, and he came to a stop first, looking both ways. It felt absurd doing it. Of course, there was no traffic in sight, other than all the stalled cars at the intersection. He weaved around, turned right, and pulled into Smiley's convenience store, got out of the car, and walked in. "Hey, Hamid, how are you?" Hamid had proven to be a fascinating addition to the town. He was Pakistani, married to a local girl, and purchased the store a few months before 9/11. 2 days after that day, the FBI had shown up and arrested him, claiming that there was a report that he had made a statement in support of the attack, and would love to help out if anything was tried locally. The arrest, to John's delight, had triggered a firestorm. The town turned out, rallied support, harassed the daylights out of the district's congressman to investigate, and finally Hamid had returned, a block party being held for him. On the morning after his return, a huge hand-lettered sign was plastered across the window of his store. "I am proud to be an American. God bless all of you, my friends." Hamid was behind the counter. In fact, John suspected he damn near lived in his store.
"Crazy out there," Hamid said. "I had to stay here all night. People coming in from the highway, it's been nuts."
"How about a couple of cartons of Camel Lights?" John said. Hamid shook his head. John rattled off several more brands, until finally he got a hit with Cool Lights.
"Still got 3 cartons.
"I'll take 'em." John pulled out his wallet and started to draw out his bank card.
"John, that's down, you know."
"Oh, yeah." He pulled out some cash, $50, still $20 short.
"Just pay me later today. I know you're good for it."
He hesitated before taking the cartons. "Hey, look, Hamid, I think I gotta tell you this first. You've always been a good guy to me. I'm not even sure about giving you money at the moment. Things might be a whole lot worse than it looks right now." Hamid looked at him quizzically.
"What do you mean, John?"
He pointed to the money on the counter. "I mean that."
"The money?"
And he laughed.
"Maybe in my old country, but here, American money. You're kidding."
"Just that I felt I had to tell you, the price of cigarettes might be a whole hell of a lot more than $23 a carton in a few days." Hamid took it in, and smiling, he pushed the cartons across to John.
"Thanks, John. I see your point. But take them, my friend."
John breathed a sigh of relief. At the moment, he'd have emptied his wallet for one pack, but now he could take them without feeling guilty. "Thanks, Hamid." John took the cartons and looked around the store. Nearly all the beer was gone, most of the soda as well. Munchies, chips, pork rinds, all gone. Hamid laughed.
"Best night of business I've ever done. Must have a couple thousand in cash here."
"Hamid, do yourself a favor."
"What?"
"Take down the rest of your cigarettes and stash them."
"Why?"
"Just call it an investment, a hedge on inflation." Hamid shook his head.
"Can't do that. Maybe for strangers from the highway, but my friends here."
John smiled. "Just a friendly suggestion, Hamid. Stash them away. From now on, if you want to sell them to friends, do so just one pack at a time." Leaving Hamid, who as soon as John was out the door began to pull the cartons off the display rack, he drove another block to the center of town, again weaving around the stalled cars, and turned up Montreat Road, usually the route of his daily commute to the college. The fire station and police station were on his right, and there was a moderate-sized crowd there, all looking in his direction.
He pulled in, got out of his car, this time locking it and pocketing the keys.
"Hey, John, how the hell did you get that old beast rolling?"
It was Charlie Fuller, the town's director of public safety, which made him head of both the fire department and the police department. He was also a long-standing member of their Civil War roundtable, and often John's chief antagonist when it came to debates about the constitutional justice of the Southern cause. John looked around at the open parking area. All the fire engines were hangared inside the building along with the ambulance.
"Anything moving here?" he asked. Charlie shook his head. "Nothing. It's been a difficult night." "How so?" "Somewhere around a dozen dead, for starters."
"What?"
"Heart attacks, mostly. One overweight, out-of-shape guy walked in from the highway and collapsed right here, right where we're standing. I have no ambulance, nothing. We got Doc Keller over, but the guy was already gone."
Charlie hesitated.
"Three dead up at the nursing home. Tyler's okay, though," he added quickly. "At least last I heard. Folks have been walking in or riding bikes in, reports of accidents, and that fire up on Craggy."
"Yeah, I saw it."
"Someone said it was a plane, a large one, going in."
John didn't say anything.
"John, all my communication links are down. Everything. Landline, phone, radio. I have not heard a word from Asheville, and I'm in the dark."
"What I figured." There was the sound of a rattling engine, a sound he could instantly recognize, and around the corner an old Volkswagen van appeared, driven by Jim Bartlett, John's neighbor from down the street. Jim pulled up by John's Edsel and got out. The sight of Jim always cracked John up. It was as if he had stepped out of a time machine from 1970. Raggedy jeans, collarless shirt, headband like the kind Willie Nelson used to wear. The only giveaway of time passage, the fact that Jim's chest-length beard and short-length hair were nearly all gray.
"Hey, guys, what's happening?" Jim asked with a bit of a sardonic smile. "So your old VWs are still running," Charlie replied. Jim smiled. "Even if the world is coming to an end, my man, they'll keep on rolling right up until the final big boom."
"Well," Charlie said quietly, voice pitched low so others wouldn't hear, "I prefer you not going around saying it's the end of the world."
"But it is," Jim replied, still smiling.
"Been saying it for years. The Mayan prophecy. They were saying December 2012, but somebody obviously got the date wrong."
He raised his voice a bit. "This is it, my friends. The day of doom, just like them Mayans predicted."
John looked around. Half a dozen small groups were gathered outside the station, and as Jim spoke, people started to turn and look towards him.
"Been telling you all for years that this day was coming," Jim announced.
Strangely, he was still smiling.
"The Mayans had it right."
"My kid told me about that last night," someone replied.
"Yeah, some sci-fi guy wrote a book about it. My boy gave me the book, and it seemed on the mark with all of this. Jim's right, this could be it."
John had always liked Jim. In almost every way, he was a level-handed, gentle soul. But he did harbor a few eccentric ideas, and now he had an audience.
"Power going off is just the starter. Wait until you see what happens to the sun."
"Damn it, Jim," Charlie hissed. "Come over here." Charlie forcefully put a hand on Jim's shoulder, moving him closer to the firehouse, John following.
"Are you crazy?"
Charlie whispered hoarsely. "You want to start a panic?" Jim looked at him, confused.
"I should haul your butt inside right now for inciting panic."
"Just a minute," John interjected, putting his hand on Charlie's and pulling it off Jim's shoulder.
"Jim, maybe you're right," John said hurriedly, "but there are a lot of kids standing around. You want to scare the crap out of them at a time like this? Come on, my friend, chill out. Let parents tell their kids in their own way. Please."
Jim nodded thoughtfully.
"Sorry, bro. Didn't mean to scare anyone."
John made eye contact with Charlie.
If his friend tried to collar Jim and make a scene, it just might very well start the panic rolling. Charlie got the message.
Okay, sorry, Jim. Just I don't want the kids getting frightened any more than they already are, so do us all a favor and don't talk about this Mayan stuff for right now. Got it?
Sure, my man. Got it.
Now just go around and tell people you were joking. Calm them down, John interjected. It'll help a lot.
Got it.
Jim made a show of turning back to face those who had been watching them. Just having some fun, that's all, Jim announced.
Some fun, came a bitter reply. We want to know what the hell is going on.
That's what we're working on right now, Charlie announced. So let's just stay calm.
You two, we gotta talk.
Coming out of the station was Tom Barker, the chief of police.
Shit, Jim muttered. Here comes the man.
Tom, how you doing? John said quietly.
Like a legless dog that's covered in fleas and can't scratch?
Tom replied, and John smiled a bit at yet another of Tom's colorful southernisms.
Charlie, a question for you, John said. Absolutely no communication whatsoever, and all vehicles dead except for my car and Jim's here?
Yeah, that's about it. Also, the old Jeep down at Butler's garage still runs, though. We've got a couple of older mopeds and motorcycles and Maury Hurt's antique World War II Jeep. We've got that out on the highway now, checking on some emergency cases that people reported.
Not good, John said softly. I think we're on the same wavelength, Charlie replied softly.
Where's Orville Gardner?
John knew that Orville worked downtown in Asheville as assistant director for the county's emergency preparedness office.
Not a word from him. Guess he's stuck in Asheville.
Tom, Charlie, can we go inside and talk?
Why? Tom asked. I'd like to know why you two have cars and the rest of us don't.
Because nothing can kill a Volkswagen, man, Jim said with a grin.
John stepped between Jim and Tom.
I really think we should go inside, gentlemen, John said.
Though most of his career in the military had been spent behind books or up front in a classroom, he had led troops in the field and still did remember a bit about command voice, and he used it now. Tom bristled slightly, but Charlie smiled.
Sure, let's go. The mayor's inside. Let's go to her office.
The three went in, Jim trailing along, and though John hated to insult the man, he turned and looked at him with a smile.
Hey, look, you know you're a hair up Tom's butt. Jim smiled. He's out in my back lot every year, prowling for weed, and never caught me once. Maybe you should skip this meeting. Keep an eye on the cars. Help keep people calm, and no more of this stuff about prophecies, okay?
Sure, my man.
And Jim gave him a friendly salute. John walked into Mayor Kate Lindsay's office, and she looked up from behind her desk, bleary-eyed. They were old friends. Kate and Mary had grown up together.
You look beat, Kate.
I am. Never should have run for a third term. Damn thankless job at the best of times, and now this. Did Tom tell you that someone came down from the nursing home? They've got three dead up there.
Yeah, I heard.
One of them was the Wilson boy.
John sighed and shook his head. The boy had been a freshman at the college. Car accident 3 years ago, the usual story. A drunk who walked away from it. Had left the boy in a vegetative state, kept alive by a respirator, his parents clinging to hope. Well, that was finished.
I thought the law required all nursing homes to have emergency generation. Those folks up there are going to be facing one hell of a lawsuit, Kate snapped.
What about the highway? John asked. Any problems there? I had a bit of a confrontation with a drunk last night.
I got four drunks in the lockup right now, Tom said. Your boy's most likely one of them. You want to press charges or anything?
Nah, no bother.
Someone came riding in on a bike a few hours ago from the North Fork, said a trailer burned there and old Granny Thomas burned to death in it.
Damn, John whispered. Kate looked out the window and then back to John. So why are your car and Jim's running? John looked around for a chair and sat down without being asked, then handed over the report he had pulled down from his shelf the night before and tossed it on Kate's desk.
Something from my war college days.
Potentials of asymmetrical strikes on the continental United States, Kate read the cover.
Some of us working at the War College put it together for a series of lectures. No one listened, of course, other than the officers taking our classes. I kept a copy as a reference. What you want is Chapter 4 on EMP.
EMP, Charlie said quietly. Exactly what I thought when I saw all the stalled cars on the highway. Glad you came in. In fact, was hoping you might know something.
All right, not to sound like the dumb female in the crowd here, Kate said sharply. But what the hell are you guys talking about?
John couldn't resist looking over at Tom.
Heard of it, but don't really remember. Are you saying this is some sort of terrorist thing?
John nodded. EMP. Electromagnetic pulse. It's the byproduct of a nuclear detonation.
We've been nuked?
Kate asked, obviously startled. I think so.
Jesus Christ, what about fallout? We gotta start moving on that right now.
John shook his head. Give me a minute, Kate. This gets a little complex. When you got some time, read the article. That will explain it better.
John, have we been nuked? Is this a war?
Kate, I don't know. I know as much as you do at the moment as to what is going on outside of right here in Black Mountain, but that alone tells me a lot.
How so?
John took a deep breath and looked at the styrofoam cup on her table, the paper plate covered with crumbs.
Look, guys, I hate to ask this. I'm starved and could use a little more caffeine.
No one moved for a second. Kate made it a point to remain firmly in her chair, not budging an inch.
We got a pot boiling out back, Charlie said, and left the room and came back a minute later with a cup of coffee, black the way John always liked it, and, amazingly, some bacon and eggs.
Picture an EMP as something like a lightning bolt striking your electrical line or phone line during a thunderstorm,
John said between quick sips of his coffee. Boom, and everything electronic in your house is fried, especially delicate stuff with microcircuitry in it.
That bolt is maybe packing thousands of amps. The microchip in your computer runs on hundredths of an amp.
It just cooks it off.
Kate said nothing, giving him a moment to wolf down one of the eggs and a piece of bacon before continuing.
Back in the 1940s, when we started firing off atomic bombs to test them, this pulse wave was first noticed. Not much back then with those primitive weapons, but it was there. And here's the key thing. There were no solid-state electronics back in the 1940s. Everything was still vacuum tubes, so it was rare for the small pulses set off by those first bombs to damage anything. We finally figured out that when you set off a nuke in space, that's when the EMP effect really kicks in, as the energy burst hits the upper atmosphere. It becomes like a pebble triggering an avalanche. The electrical disturbance is magnifying. It's in the report. It's called the Compton effect. Now, come forward. When we did those articles back in the 90s, we were getting word that the Chinese were doing a hell of a lot of research on how to boost the EMP from a nuclear blast, making it a hell of a lot more powerful.
So it's the Chinese who hit us? Tom asked. Damn bastards!
I don't know, John said, a bit exasperated. No one knows, at least not here, not yet. Maybe even the Pentagon doesn't know yet.
He hesitated after saying that, thinking of Bob Scales up there. Did the Pentagon exist? There was no news. One scenario that his group had kicked around was an initial EMP strike to take down communications, then selected groundbursts of nukes on key sites to finish the job. And, of course, D.C. would be the first hit. It was maddening. John just did not know.
How can nobody know anything around here?
Kate snapped. That's the whole idea behind an EMP strike, John replied. Whether a full-scale strike from a traditional foe like Russia during the Cold War or a terrorist's hit now, you pop off a nuke that sends out this strong electromagnetic wave. It fries off communications and a lot of other things. Then either sit back or continue. The frightful thing we realized was that some third-rate lunatic, either a terrorist cell member or the ruler of some place like North Korea or Iran, with only one or two nukes in their possession, could level the playing field against us in spite of our thousands of weapons. That's what is meant by asymmetrical strike.
So, is the whole country like this right now? Kate asked. Or is it just us?
He shook his head. Look, I'm kind of tired. Sat up most of the night keeping watch on the house, so let me try to explain this in order, if that's okay.
Sure, John. Take your time, Charlie intervened.
Well, at the same time, the potential energy release of EMP grew, and believe me, I don't understand the technical side of it at all, just that I know that it happens when a nuke goes off and we suspect there's ways of calibrating a small nuke to give off a high yield of energy. Our electronic equipment was getting more and more sensitive to it.
No one saw an explosion, Charlie said, and believe me, I've asked around, kind of suspecting the same thing.
That's just it. It's in the report. And John motioned to the article on Kate's desk. She looked at it, thumbed through it.
Mind if we run off some copies?
And she fell silent, blushing slightly at what sounded like a dumb comment. We're all conditioned, John said with a reassuring smile. I tried to make coffee in the machine this morning. It's okay, Kate. She smiled sheepishly and nodded.
Go on, John.
Well, to Charlie's question, EMP doesn't really hit unless you blow off the bomb above the atmosphere. Again, the Compton effect. And believe me, I've read about it, but don't have a real grasp on it myself. I need a tech head for that. Just that the burst above the atmosphere sets off an electro disturbance, kind of like a magnetic storm, which cascades down into the lower atmosphere like a sheet of lightning. And bango, it fries everything with electronics in it.
Just one bomb? Kate asked.
He nodded. Remember a TV back in the 50s, the early 60s, all those tubes, and hot as hell? That same thing now sits in the palm of my kid's hand when she's playing one of those damn games. He wondered for a second if maybe all the pocket-sized computer toys were gone. If so, no regrets there, at least. So the stuff gets more and more delicate and more prone to even the slightest electrical surge. Someone could now fire off a nuke, calibrated to do a maximum load of EMP, and anything within line of sight from up in space gets fried, even from 1,000 miles away. For that matter, anything hooked into our electrical web goes as well. Electrical lines are like giant antennas when it comes to EMP. And guide it straight into your house, through the sockets, and wham, right into anything hooked up.
Surge protectors, though, Kate said. I spent $100 on one for my new television.
He shook his head.
Surge protectors don't work for this, Charlie interjected, and John looked over at him. We had one, exactly one, briefing on this about 2 years ago, Charlie said. Hundreds on every other threat, but just one on this. But I remember somebody asking that question. Seems like this EMP moves a lot faster than ordinary power surges, like from lightning. Not faster in terms of speed, just that the impact hits and peaks faster, 3 or 4 times that of a lightning bolt hitting your electric line. So fast that the relay inside the surge protector doesn't have time to trigger off, and boom, the whole system is fried. That's why it's so darn dangerous. It fries out all electronics before any of the built-in protections can react.
You still haven't answered my question about your damn car, Tom snapped. Why is yours working? And I've got 6 squad cars out there that are dead.
The electronics, Charlie interrupted.
That's what got me thinking on it, too, but I didn't feel it was right to say anything about it.
Why not?
Tom asked.
Panic? That's why.
I saw an article on the web about this a couple of months back, and it was a lot worse than what we were talking about just 2 years ago. Some people who don't like us have apparently been spending a lot of time and money to get a bigger bang for the buck.